This episode is bonus content, a very candid conversation about my years as an investigative news reporter.
Discover how video can help you achieve your sales and marketing goals. It all starts right here in Todd Hartley's Video Marketing Mastery. Brought to you by Wirebuds.
Hey now. All right. So this is episode 100. I'm doing something a little bit different today. Yeah, we're not going to talk about video so much. I want to bring you behind the scenes. I'm going to kind of rewind the clock in my life and bring you back to the days when I was working on the number one talk show in Arizona, and in the studio with me is New York Times bestselling author Charles Goyette, who is my partner in crime on the radio. What is up, Charles?
Todd, it's great to see you, and it's great to be here at Wirebuzz.
Yeah, isn't that cool, right?
Yeah, it's totally fun.
I think the coolest thing is being behind the mic with you and getting an opportunity to be in studio and tell people some of the absolutely crazy things that we lived through.
Yeah, but just don't tell that one thing about that one time.
Oh, yeah, that one time. Well, listen, Charles and I had a show. Charles was the host of the number one show in Arizona for what felt like forever. The concept was Fearless Talk Radio, right?
Boldly go where no other talk show host had ever gone before.
Yes, and there's a reason why, right? And so what happened, you know, Clear Channel used to send us all over to cover presidential elections, debates, the Bush-Gore recount, the first anniversary of 9/11.
Yeah.
And we were always told, don't try to outscoop the national media. You remember that?
Which was like outscooping the national news media. This is not a slam on them. A lot of them are friends and people we like. But it's like falling off a log to outscoop them because they have been conditioned to doing, you know, news coverage and reporting by government press release. So they kind of, you know, they go from department to department and PR guy to PR guy and say, you know, you have a news release for me now, something yep. I can report. So we were able to just run circles around these guys, and we've got some great stories about how we did it.
Absolutely. And the show was so big that the senior snowy-haired Senator John McCain was a frequent guest. You know, and nobody could peel an onion on a developing news story like Charles. In fact, he did such a good job unraveling a news story and holding politicians accountable that we had unmarked vehicles that followed us around for 60 days or 90 days, right?
It's not a joke. And I remember getting a call from somebody. I don't know if I should tell who, Todd. You direct me, but
Okay, here's the deal.
Okay.
From this point forward,
yeah.
And I know this is the advice that you would give me, we won't provide any sources' names. We'll just be vague. But you should know that our sources were literally everybody in government. Like, if you ever watched House of Cards, I was Zoe Barnes back in the day, but without the sex. Yeah.
Well, I got a call one day from a very senior, recently departed law enforcement person who told me I better watch my step. And that they were following me. I go, what do you mean they're following me for what? What do I ever do? Well, you've made some real enemies. And this was a guy, you know, of great credibility and yep. stuff. And I said, well, what do they think they're going to catch me doing? He said, I don't know, but don't even take your wife out for dinner and have a glass of wine.
Yeah.
Because they will, you know, because they're keeping a really close eye on you. And, you know, as events unfolded, that all of that was confirmed.
Look, I got super paranoid during that phase. I know that there were accountants that were approached. There were people in parking lots and vehicles and that you want to hide from. But let me just tell people about I'm going to give the titles and then we'll break it down for them.
Okay.
But we were involved in unraveling at least five of the biggest scandals in the state of Arizona, in the history of the state, yeah. Including the alternative fuel scandal.
A billion dollar legislative and governmental scandal.
And in studio with Charles and I, the Speaker of the House was in studio when all of our investigative reporting came together while the Speaker of the House was in studio. We didn't plan that. Just the last piece of the puzzle came together while the Speaker got into the studio.
Well, they say this is a good lesson. It should have been learned by the people in the OJ trial. Don't ever don't ever ask a question of a witness on the stand you don't know the answer to. You know,
right.
Don't ask him to try on a glove unless you know he's already tried it on and it fits, right?
Right.
Don't ever. So, but anyway, we had the Speaker of the House there, and going into a commercial break, I said, you know, when we come back, I really want to ask you about this. And it terrified him, and he put on his jacket, and he was trying to storm out of the studio. And his press secretary said, no, don't do that. That'll look really bad. Stay. So, and we tried to calm him down and got him to put his jacket back on. So he came back, and after the break, we continued the show. And, of course, we knew the answers to the questions that he didn't even know that we knew who he was involved with and the secret ties and stuff and
it was unbelievable. And you know, I walked into the studio and I handed Charles something in a manila envelope, and it was the last piece to the puzzle. So while Charles was interviewing him, Charles looked at me and he like kind of gave me an all silent communication. And I shook my head, yes.
Yeah, like it's confirmed. Yeah, this is actually so.
And then Charles goes, all right, Mr. Speaker, let me ask you a couple of questions. And he asked them the question. The Speaker gave one answer for one direction. And then Charles said, what has got to be the scariest thing I've ever heard, Charles goes to the most powerful person in the state, live on the radio. He goes, all right, Mr. Speaker, this is where this interview is about to get a little bit ugly, right? And literally, I was sweating bullets. And then Charles wove him right back through the same line of questions, except was exposing that we actually had the evidence against what he said before.
And at this point, he could do nothing but lie about it.
Right.
Which he did. And say, do you mean you've never been received a benefit from, you've never taken something from, you've never been this, but, one of the counterparties in this scandal. And he had no choice, I guess. He was so committed. They had to say, no, never. But his voice was getting a little higher and thinner as he went on and stuff. And we just drilled him. So much so that the state's largest newspaper, the Arizona Republic, beat the door down the next day to get a transcript so they could put it on the front page of the paper.
That's absolutely right.
By the way, that was, not to get ahead of the story, but that was the end of that Speaker of the House.
Yes, I think 30 days later, the guy was out of a job.
Gone.
And so right at that point, we struck a nerve in this city that we weren't beholden to either party, that our guiding principle was truth, let the chips fall where they may.
Yep.
And as the person who was booking guests onto the show, people in power knew that if they came on the radio, they were going to be in trouble. And I would have to backpedal, because there's got to be a reason why we'd want them on the radio. But I have to backpedal and soften it up. And then they'd get on the radio and it would be like, bam. I mean, it was, we saw it everywhere. We were at the Bush Gore recount. We're going to talk about that, what really happened in Florida. Well, not what the media told you, because Charles and I saw the media doing other business. We'll get to that. If you've ever seen the Super Bowl or the Final Four, when it's in Arizona, you know it's played in Glendale, not where the stadium was proposed. And the reason it's in Glendale is because of the man that I'm with, Charles Goyette, and the work that we did to uncover that. We're going to get to that Cardinal Stadium fiasco. We're also going to talk about when the show went a bit Dixie Chicks, when the war broke out, and Arizona's longtime Sheriff Joe Arpaio, that many of you know. We knew him personally.
America's toughest sheriff.
And we're going to tell you, why don't we start with the sheriff? Okay, so look, the sheriff would call me at home and try to give me stuff all the time. He'd say, you know, kid, I'm going to be doing this. You should tell Charles. It'll happen in 4 months. But I'd come bring it to Charles, and Charles would say, oh, no, we're not going to report on that. He's trying to set us up. And we did live shows from inside of his jail and inside of Tent City.
We were afraid he would never let us out.
Right. And for us, it was always the guiding principle was truth, let the chips fall where they may. And we did something. We broke a story about the sheriff potty cams.
Ladies and gentlemen, now, this was disgusting. This was disgusting. The sheriff, it was, look, everybody that knows him or has heard the name knows that he's kind of a publicity hound. That would be understating the case substantially. So one of the things that he did is he had cameras, surveillance cameras, put in the women's intake facility at the women's detention center. So if your sister got picked up driving while she was slightly inebriated, she got taken to this place. And there were cameras there. And when they were taken into this detention facility, there were
webcams. You could watch it live on the internet.
Well, I even get to that. But they were, you know, the toilets were there for everybody to see. Oh, they were behind about a 2-foot-high block wall, you know. But you could see all the women, you know, would drop their pants. Sitting on the floor.
Yeah.
You know, sitting. I mean, everything was visible. And here's how bad it was. It was so bad that every porn site in America linked to these potty cams. And it was disgusting that the taxpayers' money was being used for this. It served no purpose in the rehabilitation or the prosecution of malfeasance or people. It served no functional purpose other than to glorify the sheriff and how tough he was and stuff. So we started making a crusade about it. And finally, we got pictures. We took these screen capture shots. We made a big poster in the studio. And everybody that came in that studio, I don't care who they were. They were innocent. You know, people with no big news story.
It could have been
senators,
a senator, or
elected officials, anybody that came in there, book authors. I'd say, before we get started, I just want you to look at this poster.
Yeah.
Do those look like potty cams to you? And unanimously, everybody said, yeah, they do, because they were focused on these poor, you know, women being apprehended and taken into this intake facility so that people on porn sites around the country could watch them use the toilet.
Yes.
You know? So we made a big issue of that.
And the sheriff would call me and he'd say, look, you're my guy. So if there's anything happening on the show that I need to know about before it happens on the air, give me a call because you're my guy. And if there's anything that you need from me, you call me directly because I'm your guy. And so it was all a little bit weird, but because we didn't keep friends because we were guided by truth, right? Sheriff Arpaio would give us stuff that occasionally we'd report on, but sometimes if we had to report on him, we'd quickly turn an enemy. And this is how fearless talk radio was for us. On my voicemail or Charles's, who knows, we got a voicemail that was left from the sheriff's right-hand man that said, we know how to handle punks like you. You better watch your rearview mirror. We're not intimidated by you guys. And so we were scared, and we huddled up and tried to figure out how we were going to protect ourselves. And the way we did it is exactly like you would have done it. We spent 3 hours on the radio that night doing nothing but playing that harassment audio voicemail and asking the audience how we should handle this.
You know, they can't assassinate you, you know, once everybody knows that if you're taken out, who did it, right?
Right.
So in this case, this was an assassination, but right. It was like, you know, we know how to get you. We'll get even with you. You're not allowed to, you can't talk about the sheriff this way. We know how to even the score. Stuff like that. It was like child's play where you put it on the air and then, you know, they don't dare do anything to you. So there's a pretty even playing field when you have a powerful elected official and a powerful media outlet.
Yeah, you know, I never felt like it was a level playing field. I always felt like we went to a parking garage that didn't have security. No. We got into a car. Then we had unmarked vehicles. We went and pumped gas at a gas station that was open. We parked at home and walked up. And I remember one time I had the sheriff, and this goes back to our days at KTAR, where I had the sheriff in studio. I walked him down to his car, and the story was that day was all about bomb threats on the sheriff, you know? So I got down to his car, and he literally said to me, you won't believe this new armored vehicle that I got. Feel how heavy the door is. And he handed me the keys. So I went to put the key in the door, and I looked at him, and I dropped an F-bomb. I said, F you, this is your mess. You open your own door. Yeah. And I took several steps back. But it was a scary time.
Yeah, it was fun. It was heightened interest. It was a time of heightened awareness.
Fearless talk radio. Charles was fearless. I was terrified. We went to the, we were the on-air crew. The election evening in 2000 for Clear Channel here in Phoenix. And before the election evening, our program director said to us, hey, guys, call all the elections, but don't get off the air until...
Yeah, won't you stay on the air until it's decided? Of course, you know, we're political junkies. Of course, we're not going to give up the... You know, 6 weeks later, we're in Florida still waiting for the election to be decided.
So we were sent to Tallahassee for the Bush Gore recount. And we got down there and started beating the pavement, like right away, man. And we showed up and we got, the first thing we showed up is we walked out to the state capitol and the Supreme Court building, and it was like a ghost town, except media. You remember that? There wasn't anybody like what you saw on TV. I mean, on TV, you saw that people were pissed about their vote. But Charles and I were walking around, and then somebody would come by and hand us a press release. Yeah. And then Charles goes like this, because Charles unravels things really well. He goes, spontaneous protesters embark from all over Florida to have their votes counted tomorrow at 12:45 at the state capitol, and Jesse Jackson is coming to speak. And Charles goes, sounds very spontaneous to me, doesn't it? And then we started working on Reverend Jackson, right?
I have a mental image picture, by the way, of you. I don't know exactly how you did it, but I'm in my mind, I have this image of you jumping like a huge 6-foot tall security fence, you know, to get a microphone in the Reverend Jackson's face.
right. I first took the photo with him. Uh-huh. And then...
Oh, yeah. Todd had to get the photo first.
I took the photo first because I knew my question was...
There would be no photos after your question.
Yes, exactly. My problem is if you get the opportunity to get one of these exclusive interviews, you just have an obligation. It doesn't matter if they've got an R or a D after their name. Hit them hard, hit them good, and let's get the real answer.
And this was even before the age of selfies. And get a photo.
Get a photo. It's so funny. So that always makes me laugh. Well, when we were there, Charles and I discovered the media echo chamber. And when we got off the radio, it might have been 10 o'clock Eastern, and we walked down to the bar in town in Tallahassee, right by the Supreme Court building.
You've got to understand the way Tallahassee was laid out then, and this was 2000, the Gore-Bush election. And I'm sure it's the same way. But down in the government districts, kind of a gentry district, you know, so all the law offices and all the lobbyist offices and you know, all the people that want stuff from the government, the offices, they're all offices down here, and it's Gaslight District. It's all been done down by the Capitol. And so we're done with the show for the day, and we wander into this place to get a bite, and it's where all the media is hanging out. And these are names of people that you read in newspapers and syndicated columnists and the people you see on cable TV and
Fox News, MSNBC, ABC, CNN, the whole alphabet.
The national media figures of America that were down there covering the endless recount in the Gore-Bush election. So we walk in there, and they're all sitting around telling each other lies like media people do.
And looking for jobs at other stations.
And
it was
totally fun. We grabbed a couple of seats at the bar. But here was just one event out of many that comes to mind. It's a hubbub of noise in there, you know, with the media gas bagging one another. It's all very loud. And all of a sudden, at the top of the hour, a sudden stillness fell over the entire establishment. And the TV got turned up, and out whipped 1,000 notebooks of 1,000 reporters to write their lead for tomorrow morning's story. And it was based on what? The Larry King Show was starting, and whoever he had on as a guest was going to be the lead story of the article that they were going to file that night for tomorrow's publication.
And we looked around like, did that just happen? Is everybody taking their notes off of the TV? Even when like the Supreme Court would come out with a ruling, Charles and I would leave the only bar, which in the daytime was the restaurant, and we'd go down to the Supreme Court building to watch this live, and we'd see all the familiar faces on network television going back into the bar to take notes off of the TV, and we'd get in front of the Supreme Court building to find out who the next president is, and it's just cameras, no reporters. Right? They're all taking notes off the TV.
They're all taking notes off the TV and covering the story by government handout. Well, we didn't do that. Before we went to Florida, we started paving the way for ourselves. We started actually developing contacts in Florida so we could do what's called real enterprise reporting. So we could, you know, break some news instead of going down there and, you know, hanging around and drinking in the bar after hours with national reporters. So we started cultivating some sources. You may want to tell just how easily sources can be cultivated.
And not only any sources, but the speaker, may I do that?
I would just say senior elected political officials.
Okay. So the two highest elected officials in the state of Florida, is that good?
That'll do. That's a good placeholder.
All right. So we sent them, I think I sent them sweatshirts that said property of the Electoral College 2000, right? With our radio station on it. And I asked them if they'd come on the air with us from Phoenix while we were there. So they both joined us because everybody, what you discover is really everybody is, they're media sluts. Like anybody they can talk to with a microphone, they're going to have a conversation. And so we ended up landing interviews with the two highest elected officials in the state. And then when we got to Florida, we dropped them another call. And then they started leaking stuff to us because we gave them sweatshirts.
For sweatshirts. Everybody listening to this program has some interest in the media, digital communications, advertising, things like that. I want to tell you, it's hard to imagine. But, it's not just politicians that can be bought off with a couple of cheap T-shirts. Listen. The biggest names in the media, if you ever get called in or one of your clients gets called in to do a TV show, an interview, a guest spot, a big radio program, big TV program, something like that, all you have to do is stop at Dunkin' Donuts, spend $6 on a dozen donuts, and you walk in there and you give, you know, maybe the star of the show that's going to interview you doesn't get a donut because he's busy getting his makeup on, right? But the whole production staff, you can, you know, here's a media star. The guy makes $800,000 a year, right, to anchor a half-hour show once a day. But for $6 worth of donuts, you can buy off the whole program. You can buy their affection. That's all we're saying. Just like we, you know, just like we bought the affection of elected officials in Florida with some T-shirts. We got their attention. They knew who we were. They appreciated it.
Yeah.
Everybody appreciates a donut at 7 o'clock in the morning with their coffee.
So we're going to explain in just a moment how those sweatshirts that we sent for free to the highest members of the Florida governing body ended up leaking to my phone 8 hours before CNN found out who the next president was going to be. We're going to tell that story in a moment, okay? But let's go back to the bar. Because it's like 10 o'clock at night. All these reporters are taking notes. Charles and I get the only seats at the bar. And while we're sitting there, Charles just starts unraveling things. It's part of what he does. And as we're sitting at the bar, he looks through the glass into the kitchen and he says to the bartender, "Hey, what's going on in the kitchen? There's a lot of people here for 10 o'clock at night.
Every busboy from the day shift, every waitress off of work, every cashier, everybody in the entire that already was off work and gone home. The place was crowded in there. We're so busy. There was a hubbub of activity going on back in the kitchen, even though the people that were there were only drinking and having maybe a little chicken wings or something.
But the reporters weren't paying attention to them at all. They were into
getting
Larry
their
King.
Story from Larry King. So he said, "Well, what are they doing back there?" And she said, "Oh, they're making sandwiches." I goes, "Making sandwiches? What for?" And she said, "Well, over here in the adjacent empty daytime dining room, you could see there were hundreds and hundreds of sandwich bags stood up upright, and they were spreading mayo and mustard and stuff and slapping chicken and whatever on these sandwiches, a little lettuce, wrapping them up, and they were dropping them in these hundreds of bags there, and a little mint, a little red mint, a bag of chips and a soft drink. They were filling these lunch bags, hundreds of them." And I said, "Oh, who are you doing that for?" And
she said, "It's got to be expensive."
Well, she said, "Well, these guys in that office across the street ordered."
And then Charles goes, "Okay. You mean that office right there?" And we just pointed right through the glass, the other glass window.
So we went over. I went over to see what office it was, and it was an office of one of the labor unions.
Yes.
And so the labor union was already preparing lunch.
For the spontaneous protest.
For the spontaneous erupted protest that was So anyway, so we knew something was up. And
the next day we showed up on location. Remember, the press release said 12:45, spontaneous protesters from all over Florida going to embark to have their votes counted. So we showed up at 12:30 and we were like, "This is a ghost town around here. Where are all these people we've been seeing on TV that are pissed off?"
And they started filing in. And as they filed in, they were handed placards,
dude, the buses.
Pre-printed signs, you know, that this was what we're protesting. Nobody wrote a sign. They were all pre-printed, and they were handed little lunch bags for being there. And it's like, well, wait a minute. Where did all these people, these are disaffected Florida voters who are so angry that their vote is being miscounted or not counted. They're so angry. Where did they all come from so suddenly? And so I asked one of the ladies, I said, "How'd you get here?" She was filing in. She says, "Oh, we from a bus here. I'm from South Carolina." I said, "You're from South Carolina. And she said, yeah, they bust us in. I said, what do you mean? And she said, well, it's a mandatory union thing, and they bust us in from South Carolina. And I said, oh, well, you must be really concerned about this election thing then, because, you know, you've taken the day off work and, you know, to drive all the way, you know, with hundreds of your colleagues to come out here and protest. She said, no. In fact, to tell you the truth, I wish I didn't have to be here, because when my kids come home from school, I won't be there this afternoon.
And we got all this on the mic.
Oh, my gosh. And so then the next thing we do is like, oh, let's go see these buses. And there were I can't even remember, there were
Alabama, Georgia, South Carolina, all Mississippi, over, all the license
all
plates.
All over the Southeast, all these buses were transporting people down there to be the spontaneously outraged Floridian voters who wanted their votes to count. The whole thing was orchestrated.
So we start, do you remember when we filed in with the crowd and you were like, we both had mics and we were asking questions. So where are you from? How long did it take you to get down here? Well, I'm from Mississippi. It took me X number of hours, blah, blah. We didn't find a single person from Florida except that Bob guy.
Bob the protester. There was a professional Floridian protester, well known. He showed up at everything. He had a funny sign about everything. He was there. Bob the protester. We even made him a character after that on our show.
Because he's the only one in Florida.
The only Floridian protester. So, and the rest of them were bussed in at somebody else's instructions.
They were movie extras.
Yeah, they were like movie extras to show up at this protest. And they didn't know the issue, and they didn't want to be there, but it was a mandatory thing.
And then at 12:45, they took their signs, and they acted mad, and they walked in front of the cameras. And at 12:50, they were sent off to the next location.
Wait a minute. There's one more piece of the story you forgot. There's the piece of the story where they started chanting. And it's like, every vote must count. Every vote, or some variation. I'm sure it had a little more rhythm than that or something, but there was some chant they started
chanting. Stay out the bushes.
So Todd goes back around behind the steps. So this is at the Florida State Supreme Court. He goes back around the steps, and all of a sudden he discovers there's a guy there with headphones on and a microphone, and he's got agents out in the crowd with earphones on, and he's choreographed these chanting. And then he goes, we demand a count. We demand a count. Then all of a sudden, about 30 seconds later, the whole crowd gets the thing, and we demand a count. We demand a count. But Todd watched the whole thing of this guy. And here are these people out protesting. They had no idea what the issues were or why they were there, didn't want to be there. But the whole protest was beautifully choreographed. And the signs were given to them, and they were given a wonderful lunch that we'd seen them make the night before in the bar with all the reporters who didn't see any of this stuff going on right under their eyes. But the funny thing is that when you watch the news coverage on the networks and stuff, or in the big newspapers of this whole protest, it was repeated ad nauseum. You know, oh, the spontaneous protester of Floridians really got it off their chest today. They turned out by the hundreds into the Florida Supreme Court courtyard area to protest the stealing of their votes and this, that, and the other. And Jesse Jackson was there sharing his outrage and stuff like that. And by the way, I don't know if I'm cutting ahead of the story, but when we got back, I called up the president of the union that was responsible for this thing. And I asked him, how much did you pay Jesse Jackson to be there? The concerned citizen. Oh, we paid him. And he told me, I don't remember the number of these years, but we paid him $40,000 or something if he'd come there and, you know, be a media draw, because the media is addicted to, you know, people who are media draws.
That's right.
You know, and help them stage this so-called spontaneous protest.
But the media echo chamber is really interesting for people to understand, because the press release was the established narrative that the media wanted to get, that the establishment wanted to get out, and the media echoed the narrative even though none of that happened on location.
And it goes on to this day. I mean, I just wrote an article today about, you know, a news event that is clearly choreographed and didn't happen that way. And it's become a talking point of everybody in the media that, well, the thus and such so-and-so said, but the thus and such so-and-so never said. But it's gained a life of its own by being repeated and bouncing back and forth in the echo chamber so long that it's become part of the conventional wisdom. This goes on all the time in America and in the American media. You know, things become the conventional wisdom because they're heard reverberating throughout the media echo chamber without regard to whether they're true or not.
Absolutely. Now, I promised the audience that I'd tell them the story about how we broke who was going to be the next president 7 hours before. Now, earlier I said 8 hours, and there's a reason. Because we got a call from one of those two people that we gave sweatshirts to that said, hey, Todd, you guys should know that tonight the Florida legislature is going to vote that
we're going to convene a special session.
Yes, thank you. And Governor Bush is going to win Florida and will then be the new president of the United States. So I said, Charles, I just got this call, blah, blah, blah. I gave him the whole details. Charles said, no, call the other source before we report anything. So I called the other source. The guy picked up the phone. I said, we just heard from a source well-placed that blah, blah, blah. He said, that's exactly what's going to happen tonight. Bush is going to be confirmed and the election will be over. And so we hung up the phone. We had the TVs on. Nobody was reporting any of that. And for 1 hour in our hotel room, we debated, do we break the story across on Clear Channel stations?
Do we go with this or not?
Yeah. Do we lose our career if we're wrong, right? And it took 1 hour. And after that 1 hour, we decided to go with our sources. We broke the story and then bit our fingernails for 7 hours until CNN broke the news.
And it all panned out. But, you know, those are reliable. They were reliable sources, highly credible, and in a position to make things happen. So, I mean, when they say, you know, this is what's going to happen, they are the people that are orchestrating the action.
Especially if they owe you
a T-shirt.
All right. The Cardinal Stadium. Like, I drive on the 101, and I well up with pride knowing that after 9/11, we stood up, fought the powers in this city, and didn't put the Cardinal Stadium where all the money wanted it to be, which is 1.6 miles directly underneath the flight path to Sky Harbor.
Well, here's the thing that really got us on the case of it. At least this is what irritated me the most. There, the issue of building a publicly financed stadium, you know, $1.5 billion or whatever it was, and forgive me if I'm wrong on the price, but it was somewhere in that range, but it's been so many years ago, I don't think about this stuff until Todd and I go out for a glass of wine or something.
Yeah.
But whatever the price was, there was so much funny business about it. The citizens got to vote about whether they should be taxed to pay for this stadium.
Which happens in every city.
Which happens all the time. So the proposition that was put before the citizens was, if you vote yes, the stadium will be located on one of these five sites. And the people, squeaker election, the people, I think we could have changed the election had we started our show a month earlier, but for some reason it passed. Squeaker election. The minute the votes were counted, now on the ballot it said, and in the voter's guide it said, and everywhere there was literature, it said, one of these five sites that we have identified, they are this, that, the other, and so on and so forth. One of these five sites will be selected by a selection committee for the Cardinals Stadium. Okay, the votes are counted. And all of a sudden, the stadium committee comes around, which is basically owned by the football team's hierarchy. The stadium committee comes around and says, we're going to substitute one of the sites now. Wait a minute. Hold the phone. You have five sites to choose from. You're not going to substitute some other site that you've been keeping in your back pocket that is more profitable for your private real estate development deals. You're not going to slip in a substitute site for the five that have been identified. Ain't going to happen. And that's when they first got on the wrong side of us.
And so what we started doing is we started tracking, because they had these different site locations. But if I remember correctly, we went down to some type of real estate database somewhere in the Capitol. I don't know where it was. We looked up everybody's name on the site selection committee, and they all had property conveniently located around one of the sites.
Well, mainly it was, I think, that the people that controlled the development rights at what was clearly the favored site that was the substituted one, the one that snuck in, that wasn't on the ballot, the people that controlled the real estate development rights there were people with, let's say, conflict of interest. And I just think we ought to leave it at
that. So 40 days before the site selection committee was going to announce where the stadium was going to be placed, we pulled off one of the greatest media stunts this city will ever see. We created a press release, pushed, this is when people read press releases, And we pushed it out to all of the major news networks here in town that the Cardinals were going to announce the stadium site, and there was going to be a groundbreaking, and an NFL football player was going to be there to throw out the first Jake Plummer interception, and there were cheerleaders and a marching band. So we got high school marching band, and we got an NFL football player, Mark Carrier, there, and we went down to the site, and the media showed up, and we handed them all the dirt on the members of the site selection committee, and the band played, and the Cardinals were livid, right? John McCain was involved in this in some crazy way because—
Well, we were basically telling them that it was a cooked deal. This is the site they're going to select.
40 days before.
Yeah. This is, it's all a pretense. It's all a sham, the selection committee stuff. They substituted a site that they wanted from the beginning. And after all of these hearings and so on, all this site selection process, this is going to be the site. So we thought, well, why waste people's time? We'll announce it now. This is the official announcement. So we just preempted them, made the announcement. This is what they're going to choose. And here are some of the reasons that this may be chosen. And we divulged... who would have some of the adjacent developmental rights and real estate and stuff like that. And so
we had hard hats on.
Oh yeah. We had a groundbreaking, I think you brought a shovel that,
a big shovel that you'd have from a
anyway, it was a lot of fun. And we went out there, and of course the site selection was, not for the safety of the fans or the convenience of the attendees, but was for the real estate development welfare of, parties that interest in the case that were able to kind of control the process. And it didn't seem to matter to them that they were kind of like, as we phrased it, at the end of the runway at one of America's busiest airports. They didn't seem to worry about what would ever happen when a plane comes in and drops a cowling or has to, has a problem or something, and there are 45,000 fans in a football stadium at the end of the runway. You know, how wise was that?
And so, we knew it was a cooked deal when the attorney general of the state told us live on the radio, Charles, pilots don't use the full runway. So even though it's only 1.6 miles away, they take off a lot earlier than the end of that runway.
The pilots don't need the whole runway.
Yeah.
Oh, well, then we'll just drop this whole protest.
Sorry, our bad. So I got a call one day. This is Fearless Talk Radio. I got a call on my cell phone that said, hey, Todd, we've got some documents that you guys need to get a hold of because it really implicates a lot of people that are pushing for this stadium site. Where, and I didn't know this person, where can we meet you to hand you the documents? And all I could think of was, bang, bang, you're dead in a parking lot. So I was like, hey, Charles, these guys want you to come meet for picking up some documents. And Charles was like, oh, no, they called you.
Good luck, Todd. You're screwed. I've got other plans that day.
Right? So we strategized. We're like, oh, no, what's the safest place that you could go that you've ever seen in a movie where you could get documents and you're not going to get bang, bang, shot? So we decided that I was going to meet at Fashion Square Mall in the shoe store, like Foot Locker in the shoe aisle, because in my mind, there's like 7 different parking lots, right? So they wouldn't know where I parked. And if somebody wanted to bang, bang me, they'd have to run through the entire mall in order to get out. Well, anyway, so I did my document switch. It went off. Like, it was just brilliantly, and I was able to tell the story about it later, but I took those documents home. It was a Friday, and I went back to our little apartment where my fiance and I lived, and the whole weekend, I could just picture that door being kicked in, bang, bang, you've got these it was bad.
Well, we had cultivated a lot of whistleblowers and secret sources because they knew that we were going to treat information without fear or favor. You know, we were going to tell the people the truth. We weren't going to protect any special interests. We weren't going to hide something because it would embarrass people in high position and stuff. So we started cultivating these whistleblowers. People were coming out of the woodwork to deliver us documents, information, and so on, which all served us really well. We would take it and we'd run it through, usual kind of a vetting process and find out, what we would use and what we wouldn't use. Anyway, these are our memories of 15-year-old events, and I hope we haven't, used the wrong name for somebody or is the wrong location, but it's basically, this is kind of impressionistic the way that 15 years later we kind of recall it.
And it was a really magical time.
And by the way, we ended up moving the stadium location probably about three times before they finally settled on where they should have gone probably in the first place.
Hey, but we never have to worry about a, you know, post 9/11, about an airplane going near that stadium while it's filled on a Super Bowl.
Yeah. I mean, here's the thing. The FAA didn't want it there. The air traffic controllers didn't want it there. The Airline Pilots Association didn't want it there. Nobody wanted it there except the people that had the real estate development rights adjacent to it. They wanted a big project there, new roads coming in and stuff. And then, you know, a place where, you know, people could go after the game to restaurants or before the game. And they'd have all these entertainment venues that they would build, you know, that weren't part of the public process, you know, weren't part of the public, you know, just private real estate developments. That's why they wanted their substitute location. And so, you know, the whole thing kind of smelled.
And while you're here, let's tell the Dixie Chick story because, all right, so at the end of my time with Charles, you know, my digital career started taking off. My news site was...
Okay, let me interject something here. He did leave me. He did leave the show. It was one of the most successful and great radio shows you've ever heard. And Todd decided to leave. He had other things. But before he totally got out the door, he started doing something that was kind of interesting and stuff. But anyway, it was the 1 year anniversary of the 9/11. And I said, my radio station wanted to send me to do the 1 year anniversary at the World Trade Center, you know? And of course, yeah, I want to do that. But, you know, Todd and I have been a unit on this thing. I want to get Todd. Well, Todd's off doing something else. And they said, no, we can't. And I said, I'll pay his airfare.
That's right.
You know, I want Todd coming with me on this deal. And so, because I was already booked there, they booked me in one hotel. Now, this was a big event. This is a big national event. They booked me in one hotel, but the town was, a lot of the rooms were taken up because people were coming from all over the country for the 9/11 commemoration 1 year later. Yeah. So I was booked down by the Ground Zero site at it was at Robert De Niro's hotel in Tribeca, in Tribeca. And they couldn't get Todd in down there because it was all booked. So Todd stayed at some place up off of Park Central up in Midtown. And as it happened, he was in the same hotel with that girl who'd been the stripper.
Anna Nicole Smith.
She'd been a stripper and a Playboy bunny. And her name was Anna Nicole Smith. And she had just become the heiress to some billion-dollar oil man's fortune.
And she had the number one reality show in the country.
Yeah, because he died. You can just imagine he died. And she got and it would go through court for a long time, but about that time, one of the courts had decided. So he's staying in the hotel, and he said, Charles, I got on the elevator this morning, or last night, to check into my room. And he said, Anna Nicole Smith was on the elevator. And I said, oh. I said, what was she like? And he said, well, she's a big girl. And I said, well, what do you mean? He said, well, she's 6'4" in every direction.
It's true. So, it was everywhere.
That's Todd's sense of humor for you. It was very funny.
It's so true. So look, when I left Charles and my web project was taking off, this is really like the early days of digital, and my site was getting something like 36 million, at this point, about 36 million visitors a year on zero advertising and marketing dollars. It was all just content marketing and search optimization. And so, you know, I'm going out to LA to be interviewed at the Premier Radio Network. And those of you that are listening to this podcast, you know that for 4 years, I led digital for 7 of the largest nationally syndicated talk shows in Hollywood. And as I called Charles and I go, oh yeah, tomorrow I'm going to be out in LA interviewing for this job at Premier. Keep in mind, Clear Channel and owns Premier, and we were Clear Channel employees. Premier was the network. So I'm going out there, and I'm like, oh, tell Charles about it. Maybe somebody's going to call to get a reference. And Charles goes, oh, that's interesting. Hey, you won't believe my article's going live tomorrow. And I said, you know, tell me about the article. And he goes, well, you know how I came out against the war and not in favor of the war. And look, we're
The
Iraq war. And you should take the story and run with it right now because you want to run with it?
Not this really. Your memory is so much better than mine.
Well, it's, so here's the deal. Charles says to me, you know, I've been telling you, and he's been updating me about coming out against the war and how the Clear Channel station was pulled them into the office. And they said, don't go Dixie Chicks on us, Charles, You know, the war's coming and we need your support or whatever it was. And
oh, they wanted me to be a patriot.
Yeah.
That was a play. You know, you have to support the war, but we expect you to be patriotic. I said, believe me, I'm patriotic. And we want you to support the troops. I go, believe me, I want the troops all coming home alive instead of shattered for this needless backfiring war.
Yeah. So then I go, yeah, I'm going to go to the Premier Radio Network and interview for their digital job tomorrow. And Charles goes, oh, you want to know what's happening tomorrow? Oh, this is great. I wrote an article about how Clear Channel is censoring me and my views against the war, and it goes live tomorrow across the country. And I go, oh, no, it isn't.
Right? Todd saw his radio career go down the drain in that instant. He thought, oh, he's been tainted because he knows me.
Yes.
You know, I've become like an object of hate and derision in talk radio circles.
And now
Todd is tied to me.
To the Titanic. And so then I show up the next day, and I've got like a 10 a.m. appointment at the radio network. And I show up and I meet the head of the network and the VP of digital, and I meet all these people. And in my meeting, the first person looks at it and goes, Phoenix, KFY, Clear Channel, Charles Goyette. And isn't that the guy who went Dixie Chicks and said that Clear Channel was trying to, isn't that the, and I go, he was fine when I was with him, right? And then, like, the day that, you know, like Monica Lewinsky's parents, the day the blue dress arrived, I was dragged into every room to meet people and get more information.
Yeah,
and
they were all curious.
They were like, you got it. This is the guy that worked with Charles Goyette. What was he like? Hey, he was fine when I was with him. But somehow I got the job.
Yeah, you got the job on your own merits.
And
despite my best efforts.
Right. And somehow the story just unfolded. But while we were here in Phoenix and we were on top of the news, we were literally a thorn in the side of the establishment that had a narrative they wanted to tell. And anybody that was interested in truth would get in their way. They'd be in a world of trouble.
Yeah, I mean, there was nothing partisan about what we were doing. There was nothing, you know, no special interest that we served. It was just, you know, do the people have the right to the truth? You know, and of course the obvious answer, unless you're a creep, well, of course the people have the right to the truth. Do they have the right when they get a ballot that says the site will be chosen from one of these five places? If you vote yes, if the people vote yes, it's going to be one of these five. Do they have the right to have that prevail, or can somebody sneak in and say, hey, we got a substitute site now. We're going to take that one out. We're going to put this one in. Do the people have the right to the truth?
Yeah.
Even about the Iraq war. Do the people have the right to the truth?
Hey,
yeah. The conclusion is yes.
Charles, I don't know if the people appreciate somebody who's just beholden to the truth and not beholden to party. Give you an idea is one election day, I did the morning counting of ballots at the Democrat headquarters in Phoenix, and the afternoon helping not count ballots, get out the vote. That's what it was. And then the morning, get out votes at the Republican office. And in both places, there's no home for people that are interested in being guided by the truth. Because in both places, they were like, there's that guy. Don't let him anywhere near us. Like, I was a thorn in the side in both rooms, pushed off into a corner.
Yeah.
Really weird.
Well, the media doesn't serve you if it's not serving you without fear and favor and without an attitude of demanding transparency of the public's affairs. Look, this is the way America is supposed to be. The things that the things that you do in your home or in your private life are supposed to be private. You know, nobody's allowed to eavesdrop on you or watch you. You know, your affairs are your business, not my business, not Todd. They're your business. But the things the government does are supposed to be an open book for us all to see. Now, somehow, didn't want to get off on a political commentary, but somehow things are kind of topsy-turvy. And your affairs and your business are wide open now, and the government wants to conceal, close, go behind closed doors and stuff on things that it does. You know, I mean, look, we're talking about, what were we talking about the other day? It's been 50 years since
JFK.
50 years since JFK.
It's more than that, but
it's been more.
It's good enough with my math.
That's a great example, because there are still documents that are under lock and key at the CIA in the Kennedy assassination that they have kept on. Who are they afraid is going to see it? ISIS is going to find out, you know, who was involved in the Kennedy. I mean, who are they afraid of seeing it? You know, what we learn over time is when the government hides stuff, it's usually because somebody's going to be embarrassed by its disclosure, something you don't want to know that somebody did, some negligence, somebody at fault, something like that is the reason that this stuff, and then when it comes out 50 years later, it's too late to make course correction.
Just like the 28 pages.
Same thing.
Right? In the 9/11 findings. And when you do get to read the 28 pages, not only is it totally heavily redacted, but when you're done playing Mad Libs with it to figure out what really happened, you're like, that wasn't even that big of a deal.
It's the oldest game in history. Napoleon said, look, you don't have to destroy the truth. You just have to suppress it long enough that it doesn't matter anymore.
Yeah. Well, it matters. I think it matters to everybody listening. He's Charles Goyette. He's a New York Times bestselling author. That's a project we got to work on together where I got to help you with the marketing on that. And Charles's book, The Dollar Meltdown, reached the number 9 spot in the New York Times bestsellers list, one spot above The Secret.
Oh, how is cool that is right? That?
Yes. Oh,
how
that's cool
great.
Is that?
That's great.
That's one of my favorite memories of things we've got to do together. I'm really honored to have you in studio here at Wirebuzz to tell everybody the story. And thank you so much for all your years of guidance that you've given me.
Yeah, Todd, thank you for being a great friend and one of my most valued advisors over the years. And it's always a great joy to come here to Wirebuzz because you have great people here and the facility's beautiful. And I normally only get to come here for the Christmas party. So thanks for having me.
Right. Your Christmas gifts at the door. Yeah. Well, that was really special for me to get to spend some time with Charles Goyette. I mean, he really shaped the way that I look at the world and the way I approach topics. You know, I'm really grateful for the mentors that I've had along the way. And if you're just now on episode 100 tuning in, or maybe you got in like maybe 5 episodes ago, I need to tell you that it's super important if you want to understand the world of video marketing and how it fits hand in glove with digital marketing and how they work together, right, to amplify results, you should really start back at episode 1. Now, I know that's awkward. You know, if you saw me in person, you would know that I'm super buff, right? And when you go to the gym, it's easy to see people that don't want to be seen not lifting a lot of weight. And sometimes when you get into episode maybe 98 or 100 or 104, it's kind of cool to start there. But I really want you to be focused on the fundamentals. I want you to get the fundamentals right. Understand how all these pieces interconnect before you start lifting the heavy weights, right? In episode 101 and 102 and so on. So do yourself and your video marketing career a huge advantage by starting back at the beginning with episode 1, and we start to lay out the real foundation of how video can be used to amplify all of the different online tactics. Got it? Now, let me give you an insight on where we're going next, right? As you know, as a digital marketer and a listener to this podcast, I always say you got to have that end goal in sight. And it's important for me to communicate that to you. Going forward, we're going to be giving you more comprehensive tactics. We're going to be tying the news that's developing into more ways that your business can leverage it to generate faster ROI. There's a whole new sector of video marketing that's opening up around the ad space, and we're going to be introducing you to how to use video on tools and networks like Facebook to drop people into a landing page to convert at faster and faster rates. You're going to learn all of that coming up in future episodes. But here's my ask of you. I know that we can take this podcast to a much higher level if I get a little bit more interaction from the audience. And so what I'm looking for is if you've got a topic that you want to see flushed out, or a video marketer or a digital marketer or somebody who's doing something revolutionary in the video space and you want them featured on this podcast, right? Maybe you've even got a question that you'd like to submit into the show, go to wirebuzz.com/pitch. And you can always submit into me across the multiple social networks a video asking a question. And I will use it in the podcast episode and we will answer that question directly for you. Does that make sense? Please, two-way. Let's look at this podcast as being less of a radio broadcast, listen to Todd's awesome voice, and more of a two-way conversation between you and me about how together we can use video to grow business, generate a lot more revenue, and employ more people along the way. That sound like a good deal? All right, join me on that effort. Anything you want to pitch, wirebuzz.com/pitch with a P, or drop me a video or a tweet on social media, and I'll make sure to follow up. Sound good? All right. All my best to you. Episode 100. Thank you so much for your devotion and your commitment to this podcast. Share it with a friend. Share me with a friend. Share your friends with me. And I'll look forward to growing your ability to be a very smart, very tactical video marketing master.